Welcome. We're so happy you can join us for this month's program. I'm here with my good friend and co-host, Leon Weaver. There he is. Leon, welcome.
David, I'm delighted to be here with you.
Now, I'd like to tell you a little something about Leon. When I was invited into Bethel in 1990, I was assigned to the service department, and Leon was one of the overseers. Now, in the service department, at times we had to deal with some very difficult matters, and sometimes you needed advice. And I could always rely on Leon to help me out. I'd go into his office, he'd set aside whatever it was he was working on, he'd listen, and then he'd give his input. I really appreciated the experience I acquired in the service department, and Leon was certainly part of it. So this is one reason why I have love and respect for that brother. Now, Leon, what can we look forward to in this month's program?
Many years ago, Elizabeth gave up a prestigious career to do more for Jehovah. How did her decision change the course of her life? Anne will debut a fascinating new series. It will reveal aspects of our theocratic history you may not be familiar with.
That sounds very interesting. Don't go away. This is JW Broadcasting for November 2021. Through his prophet Isaiah, Jehovah made a wonderful promise, one that's being fulfilled today. We can read about it at Isaiah 60 and verse 17. Instead of the copper, I will bring in gold. And instead of the iron, I will bring in silver. Instead of the wood, copper. And instead of the stones, iron. And I will appoint peace as your overseers and righteousness as your task assigners. Well, now this reference to overseers and task assigners, that sounds like organization, doesn't it? So what is Jehovah telling us? He's saying that we can expect to see organizational arrangements getting better and better. Well, if you've been associated with the truth for a while, I'm sure you'll agree that Isaiah's prophecy is being fulfilled today. So for this broadcast, I thought we'd review some of the improvements we've seen just since World War II. That's the period most of us are familiar with. Now, some of you will be hearing about these things for the first time. Others will have lived through it all. And for them, it'll bring back fond memories. So let's go back. It'll be fun. I call this part, Do You Remember When? Before World War II, and for a number of years after that, many congregations didn't have a kingdom hall of their own, and they were actually encouraged to meet in private homes or in rented facilities. The thinking was that if you were in a rented facility or a private home, you had more flexibility. You could move the meeting place from one place to the other very easily. But there were problems. There were drawbacks. Sometimes the space would be shared with other organizations. So you couldn't leave your literature, magazine, speaker stand, and maybe even a sound system in the hall at the end of the meeting. When the meeting was over, you'd have to pack it all up and take it away. But that's not all. Sometimes you had to arrive very early and clean the place up after a particularly rowdy group of people had used it. And if there were cigar smokers in that group, you were in trouble. It was very difficult to air the place out in time for the meeting. Now remember, in those days, people could smoke in a private hall. And you could smoke in an airplane. They could smoke almost anywhere. So this was a real problem for us. There were other problems. Before we had a kingdom hall in my hometown, the congregation met in a rented facility. Now in October, the place was decorated for Halloween. And in December, there was a great big Christmas tree on the platform. We couldn't move it. Now, this was in Canada, and portraits of the King and Queen of England, as well as the British flag, were permanent fixtures in the hall. You couldn't remove any of it for the meeting. Yet, to their credit, many interested persons attended our meetings, and to them, it wasn't the meeting place that was important, it was what they were learning there that counted. Speaking of our meeting places, at first, congregations were on their own when it came to building them. Now, at times, the most a congregation could afford was to purchase the land, and sometimes that land would sit there for years because it would take years to get the money together to build the hall. And then, once they had the money together, were there enough brothers who could take the lead in the construction? Sometimes on a weekend, you'd see just one or two brothers working away at the site of the new hall. You had to love them for their perseverance. Nowadays, our Kingdom Hall construction is supervised by the LDCs with lots of qualified volunteers, and practical Kingdom Halls can be constructed in a short period of time. What about the meetings? For years, the ministry school, service meeting, congregation book study, and watchtower study were all about an hour in length. So were the public talks, when we had them. Now, at first, a public talk wasn't scheduled every week. It'd be a series of 4 or 8 talks if you could schedule that many speakers. And then for a while, the congregation wouldn't have a public talk. Why was that? Remember, the Theocratic Ministry School didn't get underway until 1943, and it took time for the brothers to develop the skills to deliver an hour talk. But in time, they were delivering excellent public talks. And do you remember when we had individual handbills for each public talk with the name of the speaker printed on them? Until 1959, only brothers were enrolled in the school. For some years, during the first few minutes of the school, there was a roll call, and the names of all the brothers enrolled in the school were read out. Now, when your name was read out, you were to answer, "Present." A few rebels would say, "Here," but you were supposed to say, "Present." Now, initially, according to the instructions, if anyone was deliberately and habitually absent over a period of time, he was dropped from the school. Later, that was discontinued. Now, the roll call arrangement got me into a bit of trouble. You see, in our congregation, when the roll was being called each week, I noticed that there were a few young brothers who were just a little bit older than I was who would answer, "Present." So one night, after the school, I asked the school servant if I could have my name read out at the next meeting. He warmly commended me, and sure enough, I got my name read out the following week. Everyone congratulated me after the meeting. Couldn't understand why. I only said, "Present." Problem was, I didn't know that when you got your name read out, you were agreeing to give a talk. I thought I was just signing up to have my name read out. Well, a couple of months later, on April the 8th, 1953, I delivered my first 8-minute talk on the theme, "Proclaiming the World's Doom." Now, why an 8-minute talk? Well, we didn't have Bible readings yet, so when you were on the school, you were giving an 8-minute talk. Well, today, we make sure everyone understands what's involved in being a student in the midweek meeting. In 1950, we received the New World Translation of the Christian Greek Scriptures in English, and we were encouraged to bring it to the meetings. So for the Hebrew Scriptures, you'd have the American Standard Version or the King James Version, mostly the American Standard Version because it had Jehovah's name. So you'd have 2 Bibles to bring to the meeting. There's the one for the Hebrew Scriptures and then the New World Translation for the Greek Scriptures. 2 Bibles. It wasn't too bad. But later, the New World Translation of the Hebrew Scriptures was released in installments. So you'd get a volume every year or two, and as we received each new volume, we were encouraged to bring it to the meeting. Now, in time, those volumes started to pile up, so that by 1960, you might have volumes 1 through 5 of the Hebrew Scriptures and the Greek Scriptures and your regular study aids. And we had thick study aids in those days. We had big briefcases and strong backs in those days. We were really happy to get the complete New World Translation in just one volume in 1961. Now, let's say a word about music. That's something that's near and dear to my heart. For many years, it was left up to the local servants to decide which songs the congregation would sing at the meeting. So the chairman of a particular meeting would select the songs, but his choice wasn't always final. Many kingdom halls had a piano or some other instrument to accompany the singing, but often the musician couldn't play all the songs in the book, so we'd have to sing the songs he could play. We got to know those few songs really well. But those humble musicians did their best to accompany our singing. Now, as a result of all this, the words to those songs we sang nearly 70 years ago still come readily to mind. Do you remember the written review? Maybe you don't. Congregations periodically had a written review of material that had been covered in the ministry school over the previous weeks. Now, we had a half hour to answer about 25 questions. But then, when the half hour was up, we would write our name on the paper, hand it in to the school servant, and he would take all the papers home to grade them. Now, if there were 25 questions, you'd get 4 points apiece for each correct answer, 100 points total. And then a week later, he'd return the papers to us at the meeting. Now, in the early years of the arrangement, I remember well, he'd announce the highest and lowest grade to the congregation. Well, thankfully, he didn't mention the names of the one who got the highest and lowest score. Well, later, that arrangement to announce the highest and lowest grade was discontinued. Do you remember when circuit assemblies began on Friday evening and continued through Sunday afternoon? A full program was presented Saturday afternoon and evening. There was never a dull moment on Saturday night. There were lively demonstrations that kept our interest right up to the end of the program. Sometimes the sets were very elaborate. For example, suppose a publisher was demonstrating a presentation from door to door. Now today, we just imagine there was a door. But back then, at the circuit assembly, there might be a frame with a painted door on the stage and maybe even a doorbell for the publisher to ring. Now, if the householder was supposed to be interested, you knew it, because the house number was 777. And if the householder was going to be opposed, you knew that as well, because the house number would be 666. Now, on one program, I remember, the publisher knocks on the door, and a brother dressed as a priest answers. He puts up a real argument about the Trinity. Talk about visual aids, but you never forgot what you saw and heard. And do you remember when each congregation had a congregation servant and up to seven other servants? The assistant congregation servant, the Bible study servant, the accounts servant, the watchtower study servant, the magazine territory servant, the literature servant, and the ministry school servant. Now, at that time, apart from book study conductors, you couldn't have more than eight servants in the congregation. So, unless someone moved, a young man had no chance of becoming a servant. So, how could a young man reach out for more responsibility? And how would the prophecy recorded at Micah 5:5 ever be fulfilled? There Jehovah promised, "We will raise up against him seven shepherds, yes, eight princes of mankind." Well, seven represents completeness, so eight princes, that would indicate that there would be more than enough men in the congregations to provide theocratic direction. But how could that be, when there was basically a limit of eight servants per congregation? The answer came in 1971. We were thrilled when we understood that each congregation has a body of elders, and there is no set number of elders or ministerial servants. As many as are qualified can be appointed. Now, when I was baptized 66 years ago, you didn't have to be approved for baptism by the congregation. And the only questions asked of baptism candidates were the two they answered at the conclusion of the baptism talk. That led to a few strange situations. On a few occasions, much to the surprise of the servants, someone would rush up to the front of the hall at the end of the baptism talk, answer the two questions, and get baptized. Something more was needed. Assurance that the individual really knew what he was doing, and especially that he was living in harmony with scriptural principles. So, in 1967, questions were provided so that the responsible brothers could be assured that each candidate was truly qualified for baptism. Those questions have been refined over the years, and today we go over some 60 questions with baptism candidates. The copper has turned to gold. Do you remember when there were very few pictures in our publications? And the few we had were usually in black and white, or only two colors. Today, our spiritual food is served in attractive publications in full color. Now, those of us who've served in foreign language congregations will also remember when a new publication in English might not be available in another language for several years. Study articles trailed by several months. Now, that's before it became possible for the branches to do simultaneous printing. So here's how it worked. Material in English would be mailed to the branches, regular mail, for translation. And if the translators had a question about the meaning of a sentence in English, they would use regular mail to send their question to headquarters. In time, headquarters would answer back by regular mail. And this back and forth, it could take quite a while. And in some countries, mail service was poor. Now today, thanks to special computer programs our brothers have developed and the ability to communicate electronically and some other factors, we're able to release most language editions simultaneously with the English. What an improvement. Now, speaking of our literature, do you realize that it's been some 31 years since the decision was made that in the United States, we'd no longer ask for a contribution for our literature? Later, the arrangement was extended worldwide. That's been a real blessing for our brothers. For example, when we were asking for contributions for literature, some brothers in Africa and other places couldn't afford to have a watchtower for every member of the family. They were just too poor. Now, what about bound books? Tell you an experience. In one African country, a missionary noticed that a young brother quoted a wide variety of scriptures in his comments. And he got curious. One day he asked the young brother, "How did you come to know so many scriptures?" The brother replied, "It's the reasoning book. I read it every chance I get." The missionary asked him, "What do you mean you read it every chance you get?" "Well," he replied, "I don't have a reasoning book myself. I could never afford one. But I know a sister who has one, and she lets me borrow it from time to time. I read it every chance I get." Well, you can imagine, the missionary went out and bought him a reasoning book and a New World Translation for good measure. It was a great investment. The young brother was later called into Bethel. And where do you think he was assigned? To the literature department. The brothers knew he appreciated the literature so much that he'd make sure the congregations had the literature they needed. Well, looking back, we can see that the arrangements back then served a purpose. They were like fine copper. We do not look down on them. Rather, we take the view expressed at Zechariah 4, verse 10. "Who has despised the day of small beginnings?" Now, as those taking the lead saw a better way of doing things, they didn't hesitate to make adjustments. That's very faith-strengthening. And the best is yet to come. As I mentioned in the beginning, this may be the first time that some of you have heard about these things. Why not ask someone who's been in the truth for many years what it was like when he was new in the truth? That could lead to a very stimulating discussion.
Thank you for those historical insights, David. When you think about how much has changed just in our lifetimes, you really see how Jehovah keeps improving his organization. Next, we have a great example of someone who has seen all of the changes we've talked about and more, John Mills. Let's see how he has faithfully served Jehovah through multiple assignments and challenges.
I was raised with three sisters, and my mom was in the truth. I remember sitting on the sofa and just talking about spiritual things with my mom. And she taught us to appreciate any assignment that we had, to see it as something very special. Pioneering was my life. Gilead to me was a way to give to others, to be very busy in service. I prayed to Jehovah, I said, I really want to go to Gilead. But if it's possible to have a wife too, and I just thought, boy, are you pushy, you know? And so, but Jehovah gave me that. I went to Gilead, and to my amazement, there's the most lovely spiritual sister, student in the same class, Lois. I met her and was able to marry her 1 week after Gilead. Arriving as a newlywed couple in a missionary home with seven other people was quite daunting, but we didn't let that faze us. We were on our honeymoon. Colombia was a paradise spiritually. We loved it so much. This was the kind of life we wanted. Lois was a great teacher in the ministry. I always enjoyed working with her. She was actually a great support for me. Obviously, Colombia had its risks. I remember in the mornings sometimes it got to the point where I would look at Lois and she would look at me and we'd just say, if I don't see you in the paradise, you know. Colombia became our home. We traveled the length and breadth of the country in our different assignments. We had been over 20 years in Colombia when it became very evident that Lois's mom would need our care. This, of course, would mean leaving her assignment. It almost tore my heart apart to leave Colombia. I felt I was abandoning so many privileges and my treasured assignment. In the USA, we were working as a team, and I could see Lois really organized, making the best of the situation. Helping her mom was really the source, in a way, of her deep joy. Helping others was just a way of life to Lois. It doesn't matter what privilege you have, what responsibility, the true happiness is always found in giving. Really, Lois got very ill. Lois never cried about her illness or felt sorry for herself. She always was focused on others and would give of herself, even in the within the pain of illness. Now that Lois has passed, I many times think of her example. And it just motivates me to carry on. Here at the Central America branch, I am surrounded by such a loving family. I resolved when I went through this situation with losing my wife to find others that were in similar situations. Maybe sit down for a coffee. Just that fellow feeling, just being able to show interest and encourage another person is a great joy that I personally find one of the most helpful things to endure trials.
John's life of faithful service reminds me of the truth found at 2 Corinthians chapter 1, verse 3 and 4. Jehovah comforts us in all our trials so that we may be able to comfort others and any sort of trial with the comfort that we receive from God. Have you ever wondered why we sing at our meetings? Or why we attend conventions, usually in the summer? Many who are young in years or new in the truth may not be familiar with certain aspects of our history. Yet this rich spiritual history is your heritage, and we want you to become acquainted with it. So, the governing body has approved the development of a new series, Our History in Motion. Each segment will look at an aspect of our worship through time, similar to what David shared with us earlier. The series will help us see that our worship is rooted not in tradition or custom, but in the truth found in God's Word. Now, for our first episode, it looks at the history of singing praises to Jehovah.
It was made in secret, hidden in the lining of a jacket, and then smuggled out of the country. What was it? A recording of brothers and sisters in Siberia singing kingdom songs. They sent it from one side of the earth to the other to be played at the 1958 International Convention in New York for an audience of more than 250,000 people. Why is singing so important to Jehovah's Witnesses? Let's find out in this episode of Our History in Motion. Jehovah's worshipers have long praised him with song. But how did singing become a part of our modern-day worship? The story begins more than 150 years ago. The year is about 1869 in Allegheny, Pennsylvania, USA. Charles Taze Russell is a young man searching for scriptural truth. One evening, he's walking along and hears something. Singing coming from a religious meeting being held in a basement. He goes in, and what he hears sparks a fire for Bible study like never before. Later, Russell and his associates make music's role in pure worship clear as they rediscover Bible truth. Charles Taze Russell may have come to appreciate the power of music to stir emotions from a music business his father owned for a period of time. He believed that the singing of the truth is a good way to get it into the heads and hearts of God's people. The first issue of Zion's Watchtower, published in July of 1879, announced a songbook, the first of many to come. It was called Songs of the Bride. It contained 144 hymns or religious songs of praise. The Bible students sang at their meetings and assemblies. What was it like to sing these songs back in the early 1900s? Imagine you're at one of Charles Taze Russell's lectures. As you walk in, you're handed a small sheet of paper. You look for a seat, but it's packed. As the crowd quiets down, they announce that the meeting will start with a song and prayer. In a church, you expect to find a hymn book in your pew, but this is a rented hall. Then you realize that the paper you were handed has the song lyrics, and it also has a place to leave your name and address if you'd like a Bible study. So when the audience starts to sing, you join in. What did songs sound like back then? Let's listen to a song we sang for over 8 decades. Here's a recording from 1916. That's a little different than how our songs sound today. Compare different versions of this song, and you'll notice the lyrics and theme changed over the years. Here's a version of All Hail by the Watchtower Male Quartet in 1935. In our first songbook, the song was called All Hail the Power of Jesus' Name, which was about, well, the power of Jesus' name, with zero mention of Jehovah. You see, many songs prior to this were adapted from existing church hymns. Now here's the same song in 1950. Instead of the lyrics overemphasizing Jesus' name, the lyrics refer to making known God's will and mentions Jehovah by name. Why all the changes? Because our songs reflect our current understanding of scriptural truth. As the light gets brighter, we understand the truth more clearly, so the songs change. Our first songbook explained the goal to publish songs free from objectionable theology, and it's been the case ever since. We don't hold on to songs for tradition or nostalgia. We sing it because it's the truth. From the 1928 songbook onward, there was a big shift. Many songs were written by our brothers and sisters. They put more emphasis on Jehovah's name, attributes, and kingdom. You can even tell by the title, Songs of Praise to Jehovah. Some of the songs might even sound familiar, like this one. Are your parents in the truth? Your grandparents? Even your great-grandparents? If so, they sang the same song as you at their meetings and assemblies. That's a real legacy. Let's fast forward to the 1940s. Some of our brothers were imprisoned for their faith. The world was at war and needed good news. So we intensified our preaching and teaching work. This is when the Watchtower Bible School of Gilead and Theocratic Ministry School started. And it's also when singing was reintroduced at our meetings. Wait a minute. Reintroduced? That means we stopped singing at meetings. When? Find out in the next episode of Our History in Motion.
Well, that's a cliffhanger. Would you like to know why we stopped singing for a time? You'll want to watch the second part of this video. It will be posted soon on JW.org, and look for future episodes of Our History in Motion. Many years ago, Awake magazine published a story of Elizabeth Balnave. Elizabeth explains why she made a major career decision. How did that decision affect her life? Let's find out in this episode of Where Are They Now?
As a child, I dreamed of becoming a ballerina. I trained as a ballet dancer from childhood. I was taught to give complete obedience to the artistic director, absolute loyalty to the dance company, and to put ballet before everything else in my life. I finally realized there's no way to get ahead in this world without compromise. It just can't be done. Such a life is empty and unsatisfying. Problem is, once you get into that, because you get lulled in by that glamour and glitz, now down the road, when you finally see the trap and what you got into, it's very hard to get out. And I always tell young people, you know, it doesn't matter how good everything seems, it doesn't matter how great, there's always a string attached, always. And then one day, you're going to wake up and it's a rope. And you can't cut a rope that easily, meaning you can't get out of the situation once Satan has you trapped in it. And it happens without you even realizing it. Ballet is discipline. And I had to figure out a way to take that skill and transfer it into my everyday life. Took some time, but I finally figured it out, because it's not a waste, it's good. But what I had to learn was to get out of my comfort zone. We were in Bethel until 1987. Jack had a job lined up when we left Bethel, and that was good. I couldn't get a job because of my physical health issues. So I probably was in bed about 5 months. Eventually, I started feeling better, and that's when I realized how bad the medical bills were getting. I just dragged myself out of bed and went and looked for a part-time job. Obviously, through all of this, Jack and I just kept praying. We knew Jehovah would take care of us, no question about that. Eventually, I did get a job at a law firm. It was a good job. I actually lasted there 30 years. Absolutely, Jehovah blessed me. And I believe what he was blessing were my efforts. I didn't quit, and I refused to compromise. When I started seeing that I was really learning this new skill and I was getting good at it, that's when I sat down and I said, well, Jehovah, I have this new skill. I want to be able to use it for you. One thing led to another, and I became a commuter Bethelite for the legal department. I'd say about 11 years after I had left Bethel, I was working. All of a sudden, I got sick again. Same thing, complete rapid loss of weight. All the weakness came back. I was eventually diagnosed as having celiac disease. So once I changed my diet, I just started getting better and better. I stayed with the law firm until 2014, and then my husband and I retired and moved to another part of the country. And now currently, I'm a remote Bethel consultant. Slave for the world, you really are a slave. If you slave for Jehovah, in my opinion, you're not slaving at all. You couldn't have a better partnership than you and Jehovah, and that's how I view it. And you're never going to experience Jehovah to the full unless you put yourself out there for him to use. I've had a wonderful life of extraordinary spiritual privileges. There's no career in the world that is ever going to come close to that.
Wouldn't you say that resilience is one of the qualities that has helped Elizabeth? What can each of us do to be more resilient? Notice three practical suggestions in this morning worship presented by Brother Gaius Glockenton.
Mary kept listening to what Jesus was saying. How commendable. She set the right priorities and is a good example for us. Martha, her sister, however, received loving correction from Jesus, as our printed comment puts it. Now let us today put ourselves in the shoes of Martha for a moment. She showed great interest in supporting Jesus by providing him a base during his ministry in the difficult area of Judea. Now this time, Mary and Martha were probably working together to prepare things for Jesus. But after Jesus arrived, Mary stopped helping, as our text indicates. How did Martha feel about it? Now, she had to care for everything herself. Can we imagine the tension rising within Martha's heart? The stress level is increased, and her dear sister sits and listens to Jesus. So she asked Jesus to correct Mary, to order her back to work. But to her surprise, she, Martha, received counsel from Jesus. How would we feel in such a situation? We are doing something well-intentioned, and yet instead of commendation, we receive counsel. Maybe our eyes fill with tears. We feel the pain on our chest. We might think we can't breathe anymore. And did Martha think for a moment, replying to Jesus, saying, "This is not fair. I am doing everything to support you, and now this, you know, from now on, I am listening to, and I am curious to find out who prepares the meals for you." Of course, we don't know what Martha thought and said. But what we do know, as our printed comment puts it, she took to heart Jesus' loving correction. What can help us to overcome such a painful moment and progress? The term often used in this connection is resilience. People who are resilient are able to recover easily and quickly from unpleasant and damaging events. It is like the ability of this piece of metal to tolerate pressure and get back to its original form. Let us therefore look at three factors that make us resilient and different from those who easily give up and surrender. Now, the first factor is facing reality. Facing reality. Let us please open to Proverbs chapter 28. The question we are asking ourselves in a difficult moment is, do I truly understand and accept the reality of my situation? Here in Proverbs 28, verse 26, it starts by saying, "Whoever trusts in his own heart is stupid." We might tend to put on emotional blinders and see only what we want to see. Many people slip into denial as a coping mechanism. However, the proverb continues in the second part by saying, "But the one who walks in wisdom will escape." This means seeing the things the way they are. Facing reality. Really, facing reality is a grueling work. Indeed, it can be unpleasant and often emotionally wrenching. The Apostle Peter had this experience when Jesus looked at him after Peter had denied him three times. Peter faced reality. He went outside, broke down, wept bitterly. For sure, he was not looking for any excuses. This experience, as well as other situations where he received counsel, helped him to make progress and to fulfill his assignments even better. Now, what is the second factor? We call it meaning-making. We might know people who, under pressure, throw up their hands and cry out and say, "Why can this happening to me?" Such people see themselves as victims, and living through hardship does not teach them any lessons. We, however, based on our Bible knowledge, understand why difficulties and challenging situations are sometimes unavoidable. Seeing the bigger picture adds meaning. This helps us as a resilient person not only to endure an unpleasant situation or a new circumstance, but also to look at seeming obstacle and see an opportunity in it. We all know no one is perfect. Everyone fails at something sometime. So our choice is the manner in which we respond. We are actively trying to make the best out of it, looking ahead rather than behind, setting goals, maybe new goals. We might remember how Brother Harold King showed this resilient disposition when he was in solitary confinement. How did he give meaning to his difficult situation by making the best out of it? He said, "I arranged for a program of preaching activity. But to whom does one preach when in solitary confinement? I decided that I would build up some appropriate Bible sermons from the things I could remember and then preach to imaginary characters." End of quote. So in our context, we can say, meaning-making is like building a bridge from present-day hardship to a better future. By means of this bridge, we make the difficult situation manageable. We remove the sense that the present is overwhelming. Now let's look at the third factor, a balanced view of ourselves. While we said at the beginning that we have to face reality, which can go along with feelings of sadness and disappointment, as resilient people, we don't take the failure or a challenging situation personally. Let us please open to Romans chapter 7, because we want to demonstrate this point by means of the example of the Apostle Paul. At times, he felt discouraged over his weaknesses. Here in chapter 7, he describes the pain of conscience that he suffered because of feeling captive to sin. But then in verse 24, he cries out saying, "Miserable man that I am." Evidently, though, Paul realized that his imperfection did not define him. 9 years later, in his second letter to his friend Timothy, shortly before his death, he stated his personal conclusion of the matter. Here in 2 Timothy chapter 4, in verse 7, he said, "I have fought the fine fight. I have run the race to the finish. I have observed the faith." Paul's problems and inner struggle did not miraculously disappear. Still, it did not prevent him from accomplishing remarkable things in Jehovah's service. So therefore, we do not berate ourselves with self-defeating language such as, "I'm a failure," or "I'm useless." Reflecting on positive aspects of our lives and reflecting on our strengths helps us to maintain a balanced view of ourselves. So in conclusion, the experience of Martha reminded us today of the importance of building and maintaining resilience by facing reality, meaning-making, and maintaining a balanced view of ourselves.
The Bible contains wonderful descriptions of how life will be in paradise. As our new music video shows, visualizing these future blessings brings joy to our heart.
Love and harmony, come with me and you'll see, you will see. It's not a dream, as I'm sure you know. These things got promised so long ago, a guarantee sure to be. We'll see. Look around. There's joy and laughter in every sound. Look and see. This is the way I to be. And those who fell asleep along the way, they live again, we see them every day. Come with me and you'll see, you will see. History, come with me and you'll see, you will see. Look around, there's joy and laughter in every sound. Look and see, this is the way God meant it to be. Jehovah's word is enough for me. With eyes of faith, it's reality. As we see what's in store, you can be sure, until the moon is no more. Close your eyes and come with me to God's world of peace and harmony. Come with me and you'll see, you will see.
What a beautiful song and video. In our program, we look back at theocratic history, not to be nostalgic, but to remind us that Jehovah continually improves his organization just as he promised. We debuted an exciting new series, Our History in Motion, and saw the essential role that singing plays in our worship. We learned how Jehovah blesses those who serve him. Elizabeth gave up a glamorous career, but gained spiritual treasures. And we saw that although John has experienced many difficulties, Jehovah has helped him maintain his joy by helping others. Before we conclude, let's enjoy our video postcard. This month, we visit our brothers in Ecuador.
As its name suggests, Ecuador is situated on Earth's equator. It stretches from the Galapagos Islands to the Andes Mountains and the Amazon River Basin. This is Mount Chimborazo. Measured from the center of the Earth, it's the highest point on our planet because of the bulging of the Earth at its equator. This train line was carved into the Andes more than a century ago. It was used by the first missionaries who arrived in 1946. Today, more than 100,000 of Jehovah's Witnesses proclaim the good news in Ecuador. Nearly 300,000 people attended the memorial in 2020. The Chontapunta Quichua congregation began as an isolated group. To support themselves, our brothers raise flowers and even pan for gold. But their zeal is for the ministry. They go to great lengths to bear thorough witness in their territory. Where bridges aren't available, they find a way. They use two boats named Enoch and Enoch II to reach remote Quichua-speaking communities. Remote communities have poor cellular service, That doesn't stop this Bible student. Look what he does to get a good signal so he can join meetings and have his study. To reach those without cellular service, the brothers use a high-frequency radio to conduct return visits and Bible studies. Our brothers have arranged for talks and the memorial to be given in Waorani, an indigenous language that's not yet translated. This little girl, whose family is part of the congregation, shares videos with Waorani-speaking children. She's 4 years old. Our dear brothers and sisters from the Chontapunta Quechua congregation in Ecuador send their love and greetings to the worldwide brotherhood. Leon, my friend, I want to thank you so very much for helping out with this program. I really appreciated the help. And together, we send all of you our warm Christian love. From the World Headquarters of Jehovah's Witnesses, this is JW Broadcasting.